I'm thirsty. Just think how many times you hear that when you're at the sports field with your kids or out on a hot summer hike or just driving around in the car. Water is obviously a go-to, but have you ever thought about healthy hydration? Element is a zero-sugar electrolyte drink mix born from the growing body of research revealing that optimal health outcomes occur at sodium levels 2 to 3 times government recommendations. Electrolyte deficiency or imbalance can cause headaches, cramps, fatigue, brain fog, and weakness. Element helps anyone stay hydrated as each stick pack delivers a meaningful dose of electrolytes free of sugar, artificial colors, or other dodgy ingredients found in popular electrolyte and sports drinks. That's why Element is trusted and used by everyone from the Olympic weightlifting team, NFL and NBA players, Stanford neuroscientists, and everyday moms like me. Our kids actually fight over them. We keep the stick packs with us when we are on the go. They're super convenient. Head directly to our exclusive page at drinklmnt.com/1000hours to receive a free Element sample pack with any order. That's drinklmnt.com/1000hours to get your free sample pack with your order.
Okay, here we go. Welcome to the 1000 Hours Outside podcast. My name is Ginny Urich. I'm the founder of 1000 Hours Outside. And I'm actually kind of nervous about this one today. I have an author on. I just absolutely love his books. He's written several different kinds of books. And I mean, you do so much. Andy Wilson, also known as Nathan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So many different things that you do. Best-selling novelist, professional daydreamer, writer, director, producer of film and TV projects from nature documentaries to preschool animation. You have done so many different things. And I'm always really impressed when there's an author who branches out to do different types of books. Like we have 100 Cupboards, but then I also have this Death by Living book and the Tilt-A-Whirl one, because I tend to like learn one thing and just stick in that lane because I know it. Even on this podcast, I always do interview style, and I've thought before, I should just do one on my own. Then I'm like, no, that'd be too hard to figure out something different. So you are this author and you've written all sorts of different types of genres. How do you become the person that can do that?
I'm really bad at lanes, I guess. I think the most important thing is being interested. Like being really, really interested in all these different things. And feel like 1,000 hours outside enables you to be interested in many, many things, right? It gives you this avenue to be interested in lots of stuff. I'm interested in storytelling. So storytelling goes everywhere. And I would say that I don't really do much outside of that. If I'm involved in storytelling, I can be involved in writing TV scripts. I can be involved in cartoons. I can be involved in writing my novels. Or writing creative nonfiction, addressing real characters in the real world and how their lives play into the real story. And that's my nonfiction. So Death by Living and Tilt-A-Whirl are still storytelling driven. As is my fiction, as is a little board book, as is a cartoon. And even my nature, like nature documentary stuff, Riot and the Dance stuff, that's all still about orienting characters to the world in which they live and to the other characters in this world. So I think it's all under that umbrella. It's not like I'm doing high level math.
Sure.
You know, I'm not teaching statistics to grad students and also writing fantasy, although there are people who can do that. I'm not one of them. I'm very much a story guy. I just don't stay inside of the tidy genre lines.
I think it's brave. I don't think that there's many authors that do that. I mean, it tends to be you're known for one type of thing, and that's all you do. So I was actually surprised. My story coming to you was I somewhere, somehow stumbled upon your quote about the diamonds going through the grate.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a phenomenal, phenomenal quote. And I was posting it often. So I knew your name, but then I was like, oh, wait, we have some of his other books, the kids' novels. Then I realized that Sam Smith knew you. So I was like, oh, maybe he'll make an introduction. And then I... took me a long time to actually get to the book. Here's the quote. It was probably years that I was like, this is the most amazing quote I've ever read. Watching one small human's age and grow up packs a serious punch. It's like being stuck in a dream, unable to speak, like being a ghost that can see but not touch, like standing on a huge grate while a storm rains oiled diamonds, like collecting feathers in a storm. Parents in love with their kids are all amnesiacs, trying to remember, trying to cherish moments, ghosts, trying to hold the world. Whoa, Well, so this is this quote. Like, this quote kind of changed my life. I thought this is like so deep and so specific and so interesting. And then I don't know. So I was like, well, I guess I should read the whole book. And the book is so good. It's so funny. I peed my pants even.
I apologize.
Well, I mean, it's so funny and so meaningful. Death by living. Life is meant to be spent. And I think this is a podcast base of people who are trying to spend their lives. Yeah. They're trying not to waste it away on screens and things that are two-dimensional. We're trying to spend our lives, even if it's in simple ways. So I would love to start with where I peed my pants. Because and then when I was making my notes, I just couldn't stop laughing. Like, this is so funny. So you're talking about a trip that your family takes to Europe.
Yeah.
That's a big endeavor. You've got little kids. People are puking on the plane. And I peed at the line where it said, "We fled quickly, clutching our mooses." That's it. I was like, I'm done. Can you tell the listeners a little bit of this story of the mess, but also the wonder of taking a bunch of kids to Europe?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting where it's so easy, I think, for any parent to get into the approach to parenting that is very pragmatic. What will be efficient? What will cause the least amount of disruption? What will be easy?
Yeah.
What's easy? Like, and so there's a place for that. You're not just trying to add complexity to your life for no reason, but realizing that just like the whole concept, the whole conceit of the book is that survival is not the goal. The goal is not for any of us to survive. The goal is to live well. None of us are going to survive. We have these moments in time. Those are those oil diamonds slipping through your fingers. We have these moments in time and they just go, and they just go, and they just go. And they're going to run out. And you can get paralyzed by that, or you can really try to make it count. You can really try to enjoy it and drink it to the fullest. With kids, when you're raising kids, it's super easy to be finding efficiencies, finding simplicity, finding ways to order your lives so that it's manageable. We become these pragmatists who start to view a day in the life of a child as something that's to be survived and gotten through efficiently. Like, we're just going to get through and get through efficiently, as opposed to thinking about the duty that we've been given is to craft childhoods and, more than that, people. We're trying to raise human beings to be really interesting, powerful followers of Christ, trying to really raise characters who are worth telling stories about. And the first step in that is being willing to live stories. Because the thing about stories is that stories come with conflict, stories come with hardship, and if you triumph, they come with resolution. But we all try to avoid the hardship. We all try to avoid the conflict because that messes your day up. It just messes it up. It does. It straight up messes your day up. But every story worth living does do that. So you have your patterns and you set your patterns and you have your efficiencies. We're supposed to try to be efficient. It's not like we're trying to add chaos. But I think as we raise kids, we can't be afraid of living stories and of having them be characters in stories. And that means hardship. And so this is one of the reasons why I love sports and athletics for kids too. It's because it is duress and stress and physical conflict and all these things, but it's inside these boundaries, right? It's in this artificial place where they can go feel just peaks of stress and desire and want and lose,
right?
And have to actually deal with all the emotion and all the, you know, all the musculature emotionally they have to develop. But the same thing is the case with my kids when I was thinking about what we do with them, where we take them, how we relate to particular places that we go to, that we inhabit together as a family, that we adventure in, and all those things. They need those things. They need me to get in the car and drive the Oregon coast, not because it's about me or it's super efficient or it's going to be restful, but because they need their minds blown, you know, by the haystack rocks and the big beaches and the surf. And they need to meet the crabs and they need to meet all these characters. You know, they need to like inhabit their world.
Yeah.
But when you're going in that particular case, I think the chapter title is going to hell in a 17-passenger handbasket. That was a moment where my son had lost his cousins. His best friends were my sister's kids, and they'd moved to England. And so we're in Idaho, and they're in England. and his birthday is in March. And my wife and I were looking at a trip. We're looking at doing something. And he loves nature and he loves exploration. And so we were thinking, like, do we go somewhere in this hemisphere? We had the money budgeted. We were ready to go have an adventure. And I asked him, it's like, do you want to see Costa Rica? Do you want to see sloths? Do you want to see cool stuff down there? Or do you want to go see your cousins? And he was like, 100% cousins. So I called my sister over there and just said, hey, we've got spring break. We're going to come over. What do you guys want to do while you're still living over there? And she had said they wanted to get to Rome, but they, you know, they hadn't been able to do it. And so I just kind of threw it down of like, let's go. If we rent this 17 passenger van, could you pick it up and pick us up at the airport and we'll go and let's just do it. Let's just road trip with 9 kids, 2 couples. And let's go get this thing done. They were all for it. My brother-in-law was all for it. She was all for it. And so that's what we did. We flew 4 kids at the time, got picked up at Heathrow in a van.
They're vomiting.
They're puking their guts up as they do. Right. So if I didn't do things with my kids because they might get car sick or they might get motion sick or they will, then I'm starting to say, let's intentionally be more boring and let's take all the story and all the adventure out of your life so you can stay closer to the, you know, stay closer to the toilet. So we did. We pushed.
So you can stay closer to the toilet, which is really funny because you said you're like leaving the airplane and they're just like leaving piles of vomit.
Yeah. Everywhere. And so I it's a very visceral memory for me of standing up in the aisle and feeling this heat slap me in the neck and just right there and realizing that it was his puke and that it just hit me in the neck and was going down my back. And I turn around and see my older son doing his sympathy puking behind us. So he's not motion sick. He's just watching his brother vomit on his dad. And so he starts polka dotting the plane aisle. And when we got out of that plane, it was like, and perfect. Now we're going to drive to Luxembourg. So from here, so all the car sick kids come out. But the thing is, my kids they were pretty young, but they are marked with memories of that adventure. They're marked with the things they saw. They're marked with the communion that was created with their cousins as they went on that adventure. And it's kind of interesting because there's a lot of things like this. There's a ton of things like this as characters that you can de-risk your own situation. You can de-risk your own situation pretty quickly and start selecting for efficiencies, or you can start selecting for joy, for celebration, for adventures and for stories, even at like little kid levels. They don't have to be crazy. Let's drive to Rome. They can be, let's go find frogs. Let's go. We're going to the pond. We're going to go catch a turtle. You know, it's like, those things are huge. And if you really do mediate the world to your kids effectively, and I would just say honestly, if you tell them the truth, then your backyard's incredibly magical. Like your backyard's, it just is a world of fantasy. So if you take your kids outside and they're eating an apple, made by starlight out of air. That's the world we live in.
Yeah.
If you see a dragonfly, you know, that was an underwater submarine that was jet propelled. And then it climbed out of itself and is a helicopter now, you know, like with like piston fired wings. If you really get interested in things, then houseflies are incredible. Every single thing is crazy. Yeah. So houseflies, when they're coming out of their little gross phase to become flies, there's a perforation around the end of that little skin. And the housefly, still inside of that larval skin, opens its face up and launches its insides out of its head in a bag. And it blows this big blood bag out of its face and erupts the end off of that little skin. And then it walks out with its insides hanging out of its head and then sits there for a second and reels it all back inside and closes its head. And we'll never open that again. Like, but in order to get out, what it's doing. You don't have to go on these big, crazy, crazy adventures as much as I love to. You don't have to in order to convince your kids that they're living in a magical world. This is a magical, ridiculous world. The goal is to have them be characters worthy of the world that God's placed them in. Like God's put them in this crazy story, in this crazy adventure. They're just hobbits in this massive, you know, massive story. But they can be terrible hobbits or they can be great hobbits. They can become brave, courageous, sacrificial, or they can be really selfish and not even know that they are, you know, not even be aware of their self-absorption as they're swiping their screens.
Sure.
There's a lot of different paths they can go. And we're in charge of shaping these characters. So that whole adventure was a big part of that, of like, let's not be scared of traveling with our kids. Let's not be scared of taking them on adventures and of paying the price, paying the piper, even when it's hot and hitting you in the side of the neck. It's like, just know that's part of it. And so it's really important in your mentality that you not be the kind of person, you cannot be the character who gets upset by that. You fix it, you address it, but you can't be the person who's like, oh no, conflict, why are you throwing up? Like, you deal with it, we address it, we move on, we keep on moving.
Well, and there was a lot of throwing up. Oh, yeah. Because this moose's story, which, like I said, I literally peed. Because the writing is so good, which is, I guess, obviously to be expected, because you are a storyteller, you've written so many books. But you're talking about how over in Europe, there's so many funny lines. Over in Europe, they're just not used to seeing all these kids. So I'm going to read a couple of these. Because yeah. I read this book actually at first, because like I said, I found the quote, and then I was like, oh, I mean, why have I never read the book? I read some books to prepare for podcasts. Like, that is the purpose.
Yeah.
And some books I just read for enjoyment. And I read this one for enjoyment at first, and then I read it again to get prepared for the podcast. But I am so entertained. I'm so entertained. The wealthy semi-Germans gaped at us like we were pulling these kids from the ears of strangers in some sort of unrequested magic trick.
Yep.
Because you go to this restaurant, you got all these kids. No one's used to seeing all these kids. And when you come into this restaurant, everyone gets a free stuffed moose. So you say, we ate up the moose quota deep into next year. And then you're having this meal and you put the kids at one table. And you're at a table, right, with the adults, which we do that too.
Yep.
And then there's more throw up. It's like someone eats 9 sausages.
This poor kid, my younger son, he got airsick on the way. And then we never really got his legs back under him. I mean, he was a toddler. So this is a toddler in Luxembourg. So we got to Heathrow and then we track and we get to Luxembourg. That was some of the most striking instances of the weird child phobia that we saw, right? So it killed me. We've taken our kids to restaurants before where they've got a little thing for the kids. The idea of a full stuffed animal for a child, like any kid who comes into a restaurant gets a stuffed animal, is going to get a stuffed moose, was hilarious. And they had to actually go break into the other supplies. Like, they had to go back into the supplies and they open bags, like get out, like literally crack open the later supplies to just get 9 mooses to these children. But in that moment of foolishness, I thought maybe he'd recovered and I left him with his older cousin sitting there because he was so happy with him. And I didn't know that they were not going to regulate his sausage intake. And so he ate so many sausages. And of course, we were very quickly embarrassed, but also we were kind of showing off because these very wealthy Germans of Luxembourg couldn't imagine a child who wasn't just throwing a fit. The idea of children sitting around a table, enjoying each other and having conversation and being well-behaved, like that's all part of being a good character too. It's not like we're trying to unleash hellions on the world. Like,
right.
These kids, they were all doing really well. So we were having very much a look, ma, no hands moment of like, look how great our children are being.
I want to read it how it actually says. You would have thought we... This is what I'm saying. This is like only one smidgen of this book. And I was so entertained reading the whole thing. You would have thought we left 9 white tigers on those stools sipping cream tea.
Yep. Oh, yeah. I remember it vividly sitting there. And then we had to excuse ourselves rapidly all of a sudden where our pride of parenting went up just a little too high. And then suddenly, bam, smacked back down. So we got really good that whole trip. We got good at sneaking kids into places because when we had called ahead and like talked to hotels about, can we have large families? You know, can we have a number of kids? Oh yeah, no problem. When you show up, and there's 9 children. It was really funny. So we had to break all sorts of hotel rules and sneak kids in the back. And like, they just won't accommodate you, or they're trying to put your 6-year-old on a different floor in their own room. And you're like, no, this is not how it's just. Wow. So, but they just won't let you in. So we had to start really becoming scofflaws across that part of Europe. But it was a blast. And I knew as soon as we did it that it needed to be written. Like I would have to capture it, just mm-hmm. even so that we could remember all of it. There sure. was so much that happened, and it was so much a picture, so much a metaphor of what it is like. My oldest son is 22 now, graduating college in 2 months. And he was the one who wanted to go on that trip. He was the kid who wanted to see his Aww. Cousins. And now it's funny how much it's laid down in our family lore, how much it's remembered.
Wow.
And it would have been very, very difficult to remember all those different beats. So in that moment, it's easy to look at and be like, yeah, we can't afford this. And sometimes you just can't, you don't do it. But in that moment, you can also say, this will cost this much money, but how long will it last? How long will this thing last, having done this thing? And the answer is, it lasts a long time. It lasts a long time. If you are a family that likes to tell stories, or a family that takes pictures, there's a lot of people who like relive events that way. But if you document well, you know, then you hang on to it. It lasts a long time. And obviously it becomes more and more vaporous. You know, like it starts to recede and recede and recede. You don't remember the connectivity. You remember the highlights, but you don't remember every moment. And that's just part of it. And, you know, that's just part of the Ecclesiastes vapor of it all. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, it was a real joy to live, and it was hilarious to write. I spent a lot of time laughing alone by myself in the dark as I was writing that book.
Did you pee your pants?
No, I did not.
We fled quickly, clutching our mooses.
There was plenty of vomiting, though. So much vomiting.
Oh, so much. And that is the point, right? This is what you're saying. If you read about this singular trip, because that's not all. You go to Rome. We reached Rome at 10 p.m., traveling with 11 bags. By 10:05, Rome had lightened our load a great deal. From that moment on, we were traveling with 2 bags. Hotel staff vanished 9 of our bags before we even managed to check in. And then you said, you know, then someone's upset because he doesn't have his jammers. You know, the monster boots are gone, the coat, the pull-ups. And this is what you end with. Because I think you, as a parent, you can enter into that. You could say, look, we could play it safe. Every day we get up, you know, we pack lunches, you know, we do some school, we do homework, we do extracurriculars. The day is done, we do baths and on to the next one. And you enter into your story where there's just so much vomiting and so much just squirrely, what's even going to happen? It's very unknown. You lose 9 of your 11 bags and you say, we lost everything but our children and our camera and our stroller. We gained more.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
Yeah, it really was pretty, it was pretty striking. And I would say that my brother-in-law's dissertation was on his laptop, his only copy, which he'd happened to have left in the van. So when we were robbed, when hotel staff stole 9 of our bags, like everything that really mattered was still with us. It was just all hardship. It just was like, oh, we're going to be washing laundry a lot.
Yeah.
You know, rapidly. We're going to be hitting flea markets to replace clothes, you know, on the way. And my brother-in-law's comment was like, I think I'm buying some other poor tourists' clothing. Like, our clothes are going to show up in the next flea market. But it was wild. And, you know, if you go off of reviews, you go off of any number of things, you try to keep it, you know, absolutely controlled. You can't. You just can't. And the more you try, the more brittle you are. And it's like your fingers break. Your fingers break when you really try to hang on to it. But I think about the net value of what was in those bags that we lost versus the years that have passed of the hilarity, the joy that the cousins have all shared of that story. And like the time they got robbed in Rome when they were little kids and like, mm. you know, my monster boots went missing. I didn't have any jammers. You know, it's like, there's all this,
yeah.
it's all part of, like it became part of family lore. That's been so much more valuable than the socks and the underwear and the sweats that we lost. It is really funny because my grandfather warned us. He's like, it's nothing personal, but the Romans will rob you blind. He's like, when you get to Rome, when he found out we were doing this, he's like, just know everyone's going to try to steal from you. That's what's going to happen. And don't drink the water. So within 10 minutes being robbed as we arrived in Rome, it was literally as we were like checking in, unloading the bags, it's all gone within 10 minutes. The next day we sent in pictures of our kids all pretending to drink out of the fountains, the public fountains.
Yeah.
Like we got robbed first thing in Rome.
We're drinking the water.
Now we're drinking the water.
This podcast is sponsored by Active Skin Repair, a 1% for the planet member who believes personal health and health of the environment are connected. If you spend as much time outside as we do, which we hope you do, or really any time outside at all for that matter, you're bound to have kids that get nicked, scraped, or banged up, or perhaps come in from outside with an unexplained rash, or maybe you end up on the wrong side of a fall or a bad scrape yourself. That's why we love Active Skin Repair. Active Skin Repair is an all-natural and non-toxic topical solution that is formulated to help repair and heal damaged skin. It can be used to treat a wide range of skin issues, including cuts, scrapes, but also burns, sunburns, rashes, and other types of skin damage. It works by mimicking the natural immune response to help soothe irritation, reduce inflammation, and support healing. It's also safe and non-toxic, making it suitable for use on all skin types, including sensitive skin. It's really easy to add to your first aid kit. As if all of that wasn't amazing enough, Active Skin Repair donates 1% of all sales to grassroots environmental initiatives to protect and restore our national world, which is super cool. Visit ActiveSkinRepair.com to learn more about Active Skin Repair and their commitment to 1% for the planet. You can use code 1000hours to save 20% on all Active Skin Repair products. That's ActiveSkinRepair.com. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. In springtime, allergies can sometimes be my kryptonite. When my nose is plugged up and my eyes are watering, I feel like I struggle more to do the things I really enjoy. Making dinner, heading outside to get my sunlight before noon, and even hosting the show can be a bit more challenging. Luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medication and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for several years, and it's been an absolute life changer. My eyes aren't a constant, itchy, drippy faucet, my nose isn't running, and I can speak without feeling like something has jumped in my throat. And I love that Claritin D tackles nasal congestion caused by allergies or cold, and also relieves sinus congestion and pressure due to allergies. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Use as directed.
I think this book, you know, on the surface, because I read it twice, on the surface, there's so many different parts of it. And then there is this deep thread that runs through it. The life is meant to be spent theme, live a good story, this theme. And I think one of the things that really brought that together was that you wove your grandparents through the whole thing, because it's pointing out that we leave a legacy, and we leave quite a bit. Not only do we leave a legacy in the number of people, like you were talking about, this certain grandfather has 16 grandkids and this one has 46 descendants and these different types of things, but that they left stories for you as well. I did pee in one spot and then I also cried in another. I cried at, gosh, this was so meaningful. He was giving out notes on his birthday.
Yeah.
A passage of scripture for each of his children and their spouses, for each of their children and their spouses, and for each of their children. There was 46 souls at that point. And he had written a letter to the youngest, little note to the youngest one that said, "You may not remember me. I remember you and prayed for you when you were one day old, great grandpa."
Yep.
Wow. So you come from this family of storytellers. And one of the things that you talked about was that they're weaving tales. Spinner of tales. That's Lawrence. That's granddad.
Yep.
Lawrence was a spinner of tales. As a kid, I would beg for them and I would beg for home movies. Do you think everyone can be a spinner of tales?
I think everybody is. I really, it's not optional. So this is not a thing that we get to be, not an aspect of our free will here. So if you are in a story, it's like, you don't get to decide not to be in a story. You're just in one. God made you. You're here. You exist. You didn't volunteer. There was no other realm where he said, "Hey, who wants to show up and live in the Midwest?" And, you know, it's like, and people raise their hands. It's like, no, we got entered into a story and we got created. We got created ex nihilo like the rest of us and entered into a story. So we're here. Like, we're here. It's just a question of quality. It's just a question of how well we do. It's not a question of whether we do.
Wow.
And so all of us have been equipped to live stories. And that is the crafting of stories. When you make a choice, any choice, you're writing a story. You're writing a day. Today's Wednesday. So we wrote a story this morning. You know, it's like, I'm going to write a story tonight. There's going to be dialogue. We are writing dialogue right now. And God doesn't give us anything other than the rough draft. And that's one of the funniest things about it, where he gives us these moments. And if I'm writing an episode of a preschool cartoon, if I'm working on something like that, I would do multiple drafts. I would edit and revise and get notes. And God gives me the real world. He does the, I'm talking about the fake stuff. I'm making stuff up and I'm going to edit and revise. But he gives us the real world and says, go. Write your dialogue. Write it right now. And like, can I revise it tomorrow? No, you may not. Like, there's no revision. It's just go. Yeah. And so how you tell your stories to your kids with your words is important and valuable. But how you tell your stories to your kids with your life is far more important. We can put it into English. My grandfather could tell me stories of his childhood, but who he was as a character to me was far more powerful than any of the little stories. The stories were valuable. They were treasures for me. But everybody is a spinner of tales. Everybody is. And the question is whether we are good at telling them again in English or whether we're just telling them with our lives. So when a dad yells at his son for, you know, dropping the milk, he's writing a story. It's just a bad one. It's a bad scene. It can become a good scene as soon as he takes care of it and corrects it and apologizes. But when your son gets yelled at, when your daughter gets a massive frustration face from mom, that's a scene that's getting written. Spinners of tales are making choices. They're making decisions, who they're going to be, how they're going to function. And they're writing the stories of their children's lives. And so I think it's really important. I'm saying that's really, really important that parents see themselves as secondary characters, mm-hmm. Not primary characters. Parents need to see themselves as secondary characters in other people's stories. And that's how they want their kids to learn to live too. Not to live like they are the hero, but to be fantastic friends, to be fantastic siblings, to be fantastic children. Like, how do we train them to be great secondary characters? And how do we as parents think like that? So when my son drops the milk and it explodes all over the front steps, what would a great secondary character do here? You know, it's like, what would a great father do? And is my son going to have a story where there's a great father? Or have I decided that he's going to have a story where there's not one? If I'm the one writing my kids' first couple chapters of their biography, their life story, then everybody knows that who your parents were and how your parents functioned is a huge part of them. If I'm writing that, I'm choosing to write that. Do I write that for him as I had this overbearing, harsh father who would snap on me at the least mistake? It's like, are those the best early chapters? And so, like, can everybody be a spinner of tales? Everybody is. We all are. And we can't get out of it. We can only become aware of it and try to do it with more and more quality and to do it more and more effectively, because all of us are going to mess up, but there's grace for that. Make it right. And like a great character would, apologize like a great character would, go forward, do better like a great character would. But yeah, I don't think we can get out of it. I don't think there's any way to get out of it.
Nate, that's deep. And I don't know if that's what I was expecting for the answer, because I had actually had a question, an additional question, because you were talking about, I remember meals in the same way I remember story times, the atmosphere and aura of feeding goblets. I love this. It's so creative. Goblets and goblins, milk and villains, ice cream and orcs. I was fed, I grew inside and out. We may not remember the stories, but they molded us. And so I had the question of, what if we neglect the stories?
Yeah.
But you can't. That's the whole point, is we are a spinner of tales.
Yeah.
What tale is that going to be? That's really powerful. It's actually a really powerful way to look at life, to look at the way that we live and interact with other people.
Because we can make it terrible. We can do a terrible job. So yes, stories and the stories around us feed us and shape us. And so the characters that our parents are, that our friends are, that our family members are, that we are. Like, all of that is backstory fuel, and it's what we're consuming on a daily basis as narrative creatures. And it can be great, and it can be healthy, and it can be wholesome or not. It can be all TV dinners. It can all just be frozen food. You know, it's like, it could be that too. Dad could be too tired to talk to you. Mom could be sick of reading that book to you. It's like, that's all those, we can do it wrong, but we have to do it. We are doing it.
We are doing it. Oh, that's powerful. This book is really powerful. And I think with that piece of the grandparents, it also shows that not only are you impacting your son, your children, but then there's another generation coming. And then in this case, there was great grandchildren that are coming from this line of people, and like the two becomes 46. I mean, that's a really big deal.
Yeah.
And then all of these people stem back. And I want to talk about how even are stemming back to people that are part of the story that don't even get remembered. You don't even totally know their names. But before we get there, talking about being a storyteller and talking about legacy, I thought this part about your dad, a loather of talk without action, a despiser of tasks undone, a radical perfectionist only bothered by one imperfection, that of not doing. So you tell this interesting story, I thought was so interesting just for the sake of parenting, where you announce that you're going to be a writer. And you're in the sixth grade, so I mean, you're young still, not even a teenager. I'm going to be a writer. And you said he called my bluff. It's sixth grade is young. And so then he says, well, I mean, he has you write stuff. He yep. said, you know, I could have just sloughed it off, but instead I find myself gripping a pencil. I was tiptoeing into middle school, expected to create art with words because of a few that had come out of my mouth. So you said, I'm going to be a writer. Your dad says, here's your pencil. You say, darn it. But I just thought that was fascinating because you do often see a lot of threads from childhood into adulthood in terms of what people go into to make a living. And so I thought this was amazing of your dad. Have you taken that same approach with your own kids?
Yeah. And I coach too. So I started coaching my daughter's track team. I do some track coaching. I do some basketball coaching as part of my role of parent. But also because there's a lot of kids where I think this kind of approach is really, really helpful. For all kids, I think it's helpful. And I can do it. And I enjoy doing it. And I enjoy being there with my kids and their journeys, their little athletic journeys. But a huge part of this is learning in the consumerist age, we equate want with desire, like with appetite, as opposed to want with action. Want something with your actions. Don't want it with your feels. Learning to want with actions. In basketball, this could be a kid who says, I want to be a great shooter. It's like, oh, do you?
So do I.
Yeah. If you're going to raise your hand and say, like a little sixth grade me, and say, I'm going to be a great shooter in the basketball court. And it's like, well, okay, what do great shooters do? Then start being one and know that where those begin, where those characters begin, know what they do. So want with your actions. I wanted to be a writer, and my dad knew what that meant. So want it with your actions. Show me that you want it, because otherwise this is a lie. To say that you want something and then to not take steps with actions, to not want it with your actions, is to not really want it. It's just to have a contradictory sensation. It's like, so you've got contradictory impulses, and we all do that. There's all things that we want, and we also want the opposite. We want the lawn mowed, but it turns out we want to sit on the couch more. It's like there's these warring wills. But when we truly want something, when that want is real, it results in action. It is always active. Learning that at an early age for me, when it was like, oh, great, I've got to write now. And then my dad quoted Chesterton at me often, anything worth doing is worth doing badly. And yeah. You have to start, you got to go, you got to move. And it was really striking that I was expected to try to write short stories in junior high. I was expected to try to do this, to start, you know, working on this journey. And I was not lied to about them. Nobody told me they were great. You know, it's like,
you said your grandpa's was critical, gruff, appreciative of the effort, but try again, kid.
Yeah, exactly. It's terrible. It's funny because I think that was huge. I think that was really, really huge. I think it's a huge thing for everybody to learn. It's a huge thing for all of us to learn, whatever phase of life we're in, that if we want the house cleaned, if we want the checkbook balanced, if we want the bed made. It's like, we don't really, unless we're doing it. You know, it's just all fake. And because we live in this very, very consumerist age that's all driven by appetite, we think of wanting the same way we think of like wanting an M&M. We want the flavor to dissolve in our mouth. I want a very passive experience in which this happens to me. Again, that's not the story we live in. We're characters. We're supposed to be living scenes and arcs and journeys. So if you want to be financially stable, if you want to be in real estate, if you want to build houses, if you want fill in the blank, it doesn't matter what, then get started. Start walking, because you're not going to get any closer to that, and you will get farther away from it just by being inactive. So that was huge. Him putting a pencil in my hand was, and calling my bluff, was big, because I think every boy especially is instinctively lazier than they are anything else. And so realizing that the expectation was that you will prove it was a big deal.
You've done it. You have so many books. My father was thrilled I was going to be a writer. He took me at my word, offering only excitement and congratulations and pressure. Yeah. I think there's people listening. They have sixth graders. They're 10, they're 11, they're 12. He called my bluff, but he called it in the hopes that in doing so, the bluff would go away and the writing would be left behind. And here you are. Here you are, best-selling author.
Yeah.
So many books. I mean, too many for me to even suggest, to even talk about. I mean, we've got shelves full of them, plus the ones that are written for the adults. I think that's a really powerful thing. There is so much in here that's good for living, but also good for parenting. I love the story about the pitcher, the four-year-old pitcher that's pitching with no ball to no one. But I couldn't really figure out, Nate, why I liked it so much. I don't know what it was. There was something about it. Because like I said, I read it twice and I'm like, this one just pulled at my heartstrings. But you said, more than a decade later, I can still see him. I hope he is somewhere with real cleats and real leather and a real ball in his hand. In some ways, he taught me how to catch, even if clumsily.
Yeah.
But what does that mean?
So what that means right there is, in my own game, and this is, you know, that line is kind of for me, but in my own pursuits, my own dreams, what I wanted to do is I wanted to be able to capture moments with words. Like I wanted to be able to paint, you know, it's like I want to be able to see scenes. And when I try to train aspiring writers, and I was involved in starting an MFA program at New St. Andrews College for this reason. But when I'm trying to help train aspiring writers, I try to have them write nonfiction first, like nonfiction scenes, creative nonfiction. So can you take a moment? Can you take a scene and give it to somebody else vicariously? So if I drove by this kid and I had this experience of driving by this kid in this daycare who was always playing baseball by himself with no glove and no ball. And he was there on the regular and became this thing I watched and I connected with, and I was always looking for him up ahead. Like, could I take that and then translate it into the English language and hand it to people in a way that impacted them and they felt it? They would feel it the same way that I did. So I could tell you, just in terms of data and information, I could just relay it and you would know the information, but you would not know the truth of the scene. The truth of the scene comes with its impact, and the truth of the scene comes with its whole, all the sensation, with its whole weight. And so how can I take a thing that struck me a certain way and then translate it, pitch it? How do I do this? Pitch and catch. Catch it, pitch it, and hand it to somebody else. And now it's theirs. They just experienced it, and they experienced it as their experience. And so, and it sticks with them. But one of the weirdest things I think that God did in how he designed us is, I can try to think back to my 39th birthday and I'm going to fail. Like, unless there was some really big momentous thing, what did I do on my 39th birthday? What did my kids do for me? What did my wife do for me? I don't know. I'm 45 now. That was a long time ago. I could maybe look at my phone. I could try to put together details and try to find the memories, but it's kind of gone. But I have experiences that I received via fiction that have marked me permanently. Wow. And so the way God actually has us have stories and the written word accesses our permanent imagination and permanent memories in a way that our own lives don't.
Wow.
So when we live through a day, I don't remember that day. The day goes away. The day fades. But when I've read that story and I've got Sam and Frodo in my head, when I have Merry and Pippin at Isengard, when I've got all these different characters, different places, if we've read the same book, if we've read the same book, we've shared the same experiences, and those experiences, those high points really stick. They stick and they don't mutate. They don't change. They don't fade. They don't go away. But my 39th birthday, gone. And so it's not just another Tuesday. It's like, theoretically, it was like an important day in my year. It was like the day I aged, but then it's just out the door. And it's really weird that way. So my own pursuit was the pursuit of capturing things in the real world and making them permanent for people. Like, how do I, as much as you can in this world, how do I capture this moment and how do I pitch? And so the picture for me was the scene that I was driving by, that one of the first ones where I just felt this deep need to give it to other people. It was one where other people needed to see this kid. Other people needed to be impacted by this scene. And so I set about trying to capture the scene. It was one of the first things that I ever wrote in a creative nonfiction way where I felt like, okay, I've successfully caught it.
Yeah.
And I successfully am giving it to people. They are feeling what I felt. They are seeing what I saw. And it's impacting them in the same way. And so that was my own imaginary baseball that I was trying to grow in. So for him to have it become real, he's this character, he's this scene that is in fact where I learned to catch and pitch, is like in that scene. So.
Oh, that's really good. Because it was, you did feel the impact and the weight of it. But I also was kind of like, why? What? But this is such a meaningful story. That's really good, Nate. Wow. Okay, that's a fantastic story. People read it in Death by Living.
It's no secret. We love music in our household. And music lessons don't need to be expensive, boring, or stressful. Vogtberg Music Academy offers online lessons that siblings can share in the comfort of your own home. Instead of dragging kids to lessons and paying hundreds of dollars a month for one student, use my code OUTSIDE to get 50% off the first month when your children learns piano, fiddle, guitar, mandolin, or ukulele at VogtbergMusicAcademy.com. For only $15, get weekly lessons and practice principles, 24/7 access to your instructor, live student onboarding calls, and video vaults that provide dozens of extra lessons for students who want to progress faster. With Vogtberg Music Academy, you will never have to nag your children to practice as they work toward earning badges on their success path and performing for community student showcases. Once again, use my code OUTSIDE to give it a try. You get 50% off this month and give your children a lifelong love of music at VogtbergMusicAcademy.com. That's spelled VoetBerg MusicAcademy.com. And use code OUTSIDE when you sign up. We love bread in our house. I mean, who doesn't? PB&Js, turkey sandwiches, even just morning toast with butter, it's all good in our home. We're always on the hunt for a healthy alternative. That's why our family loves Hero Bread. It is delicious. They make delicious bread and products free of consequences or compromise. They've made carby, empty calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious versions that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories, plus protein and fiber. We love the classic white bread and the seeded bread, which are both made with olive oil and have a wonderful, rich taste to them. I was so surprised how soft both types of bread were. They were just the right blend of chewiness and sturdiness for making sandwiches. This bread is a favorite in our house for sure. The tortillas were also delicious, and we loved making simple cheese quesadillas as a snack. We're talking 0 net carbs, high in fiber, 0 grams of sugar. What more could you ask for? Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code OUTSIDE at checkout. That's code OUTSIDE at hero.co.
Let's talk about time.
Yeah.
Time. So this is really the crux of the book, is that we're all counting down. And you even had numbers in here, 200, and it's been a while since you wrote the book, so you've got less.
Yep.
250,000 conscious hours remaining in me to smile or scowl, rejoice in my life, in this race, in this story, or moan and complain about my troubles. Do you think that there are a lot of people that live their life thinking in this way of, it's all winding down. We're heading toward a finish line here. It's not going to last forever. Or do you think that most people kind of ignore that?
Oh, we all ignore it. Everybody wants to ignore it. And everybody also wants to look in the mirror and watch themselves in the mirror and catalog their injuries, catalog their pains, catalog their grievances, and kind of catalog how hard it's all being instead of keeping their eyes front on what the goal is and keep working towards the goal. There are plenty of people who've lived really, really fantastic lives and great stories. And one of the things they have in common is that they don't spend a ton of time introspecting and self-assessing. Like in any given moment, they're not looking in the mirror. There's kind of a weird story that I heard, and this is apocryphal, so I can't give you a footnote on it, but when the Empire State Building was built, they didn't build enough elevators and they couldn't handle the crush of the crowds. And especially at the start and the end of the business day, it was just slammed. The elevator lobbies were just on every floor, were just slammed with people. Nobody could get out or in quickly. And they were thinking about the enormous cost of adding more elevators. And somebody came along and said, no, just line the elevator lobbies with mirrors. Just put mirrors in there because people will just stare at themselves. And they become more aware of themselves. And they start watching themselves in relationship to others, and they're kind of checking their behavior and constantly watching it. And they lose track of what they're actually there for, which is to try to get out. And I think that we all do that. I think we're all at different phases too worried about how bad our ankle hurts or how badly we slept or whether we're hungry or not. And we're not actually focused on living the scene well and being a good character at all. We just are staring in the mirror. Then I think we have to like get eyes front and move. Like there's a wall of mirrors by us. We can just ignore and go live. And I think it's much worse with social media and everything else. We've really magnified that. But yeah, time is slipping. We've been given a certain number of heartbeats. We don't know how many, and we can get a return on them or not. I mean, it's a pretty simple concept. And I will say this though, there's a way, I explore all these themes in my kids' fiction. So
yeah,
you can, you know, it's all there. Levi Bridge, one of my first novels, covered this part, but Ashdown Burials is heavily a companion series with Death by Living. There's a lot of things like that. But Levi, there's a character who realizes he's resenting the loss of his father, struggling with the loss of his father, and then realizes that he is his father's remains. You know, it's like, okay, like I can sit here and just stare at the grave. You know, I can stare at that. Or I can realize that his story's not over because you're still here.
Wow.
His descendant, his son is still here. So you can turn and go live. You can turn and go live the story or not. And I think that we all do that. So we have to be prepared to fall over like an old willow tree and have all these shoots come out of us who are all living their own stories. Well, you got to be prepared for that. And to have them be our remains, our real remains on this earth, our true remains will be those people that we lived for, those people that we touched and shaped with our choices, just like we are the remains of those people who came before us. And it's also great to see in the story how often there's a lot of terrible stories, like dark, dark, dark stories. And now God punctuates it with grace and just changes the whole family thread, just takes everybody in a completely new direction. And there are these moments of radical grace in family genealogies where it's like darkness, 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 darkness. And then like, boom, here's this transformation. And the whole family starts going in another direction for generations. And it's incredible. Time is an extremely slippery thing, probably the most slippery thing. And I think it's so shocking. And something I talk about in the book is we don't even have the time to thank God for what he's giving us. Because to even stop to thank him for all of it would be to waste all the time he gave us and not use it. Like we wouldn't be using it. We would actually just spend every heartbeat thanking him for the last heartbeat. And we need to go do.
Nate, this has been one of my favorite conversations ever. And the book is so deep and the writing is so interesting. I always think, like, how does someone even come up with that? I want to read a couple of these because it's woven through. Your heartbeats cannot be hoarded. You have hands, blister them while you can. You have bones, make them strain. They can carry nothing in the grave. You have lungs, let them spill with laughter. Only a decade more, or two, or four, but there is a finish line. May I live hard to the dregs. May my living be grace to those behind me. Be as empty as you can when that clock winds down. Spend your life. And then you talk about just the amazing parts of life. Noticing that our fingertips can feel and pick things up, that pie smells like pie, that our hangnails heal, that honey crisp apples are real, and that dogs wag their tails, and awe perpetually awaits us in the sky. The book is extremely meaningful. I've actually not read another one like it. It's so meaningful. And thing, I mean, I, like I said, I've got these just pages and pages and pages of notes, quote after quote after quote, that remind you to be a spinner of tales. I think we have time to hit one more topic, which is this topic of when we intersect with other people's lives and don't even know, and the impact that that has down the road. So you talk actually about several examples in the book. And then they're also in your gratitude, which the gratitude was even cool. Even the gratitude was cool, Nate. The gratitude, where you're talking, I was like, what in the world? You're thinking Miss Smith, the teacher, you know, who helped change the life for your grandpa because she believed in him, but she was super young herself. The gratitude to the unknown Marines for carrying a broken pilot, to Miss Smith for teaching a boy in a cornfield. I mean, you're thanking people that don't even know you're thanking them, that may not even still be alive.
Yep.
That's pretty rare. So you say we touch many stories. I really have not thought about this too much. We are touched by many stories. We touch many stories. Miss Smith is this teacher that really impacted your grandfather. You had Marines that helped another grandfather and a medic who saved his life and his leg. And they do this, you say, without reading the rest of the book. They tipped tremendous scales as they did, changing lives and generations in ways that can never be undone. I just got like chills and chills and chills throughout this book. But you say lives and generations are therefore the tipping. You have hands, you have words, you have something. I think so often we're consumed with right now. My kids are here. I've got all of these things to do.
Yep.
And in the book, it talks so much about family, right? Our kids and our legacy and our grandkids and our great grandkids. But this pulls it out just a little bit more. And shows that sometimes we may impact people and we'll never know. How does that affect the way that we should live?
I think most of the time we won't know. I think that there's times we know a little bit and there's times that we just won't. So I talk a lot about how the kind of character you be in your kids' lives. But what kind of character are you in the lives of the people standing with you in the line at the grocery store? You know, people with just short brushes. When you're getting on the airline, what kind of character are you in their lives, in the gate agent's life, and the flight attendant's lives? It's like there's all these people we intersect with, and we have no idea the way things go, right? We have no idea of how negativity cascades, but failure begets failure, and success begets success, and warmth begets warmth, and joy begets joy. And frustration and anger and just like a sourness spreads. It really does. There was like a Harvard Business School study about the impact of high performance workers. Somebody who's really high performance, like if you're gung ho and you're doing it, everybody within like whatever it is, 25 yards, I don't remember, 25 feet, 25 yards on their floor, all of their productivity goes up.
Wow.
Anybody who's in the radius of that person sees more productivity and they start to achieve more and they do better. One person who is a toxic worker, like one person on that floor who's like they're underachieving, they're negative, they're complaining, the productivity of the entire floor goes down. So the blast radius of joy and energy and positivity is very real. But it's always easier to smash things than it is to build things. It's easier to kick a sandcastle down than it is to get a sandcastle up. So when we go through life, we want to be Johnny Appleseeds. We want to be building sandcastles and planting apple trees everywhere we go and be those kinds of people. So if we are children of grace, if we're children of the light, if we are followers of Christ, then where we go, we should leave a wake behind us. There should be a wake behind us of that's rippling people that we'll never see. Like, you influence the person you sat next to, and so on and so on. Like, I can get into a conversation with a waitress about God's cosmic plan that we ended up getting into because of high school basketball. You know, somebody said something about some frustration about the refs or whatever, and I can kind of do something and give her something brief, small. I'm not trying to get her all the way there. I don't need to try to like realign all of life. All I want to do is just hand her, you know, hand her something wholesome, hand her something warm, and know that that will have a cascading effect. And it does. It really does. A lot of people convert. A lot of people are encouraged, rejuvenated, inspired, motivated, because somebody else just didn't take the bait of frustration. Somebody else was joyful. It's not always traumatic. I was involved in a moment where a woman had her leg taken off by a semi. She was riding a motorcycle and she had her leg taken. And my buddy and I, we were the first cars on the scene, and we're sort of trying to stabilize this woman on the shoulder of the highway. And she, later on, we found out via Facebook that they successfully reattached her leg, and she has a leg. And I've never met her. Like, I've been on my knees beside her in the ditch while we're waiting for the ambulance and we're trying to get the tourniquet on. Like, I've been there, but I don't know her at all. You know, it's like, and that's, those are the dramatic ones, but there's a lot more that just happens in the simplicity, in just kindness to your neighbor, and just warmth that can just multiply and grow. And I think that especially in these times and in the kind of like the environment socially, politically that we're in, joy, like the power of joy, the power of barbecues, the power of laughter and pleasure and loving each other is huge. And like, there's been so much toxicity going the other direction that there need to be these lighthouses, these houses in the neighborhoods that are just the place where people are being good characters. They're good characters in the story. They don't care about Mordor. You know, it's like, they're loving their people, and they're loving their people well. I think that's the nutshell on that one. So being willing just to be Johnny Appleseeds and let God do with it what he's going to.
Yeah. What a book. What a book, Nate. Death by Living, Life is Meant to be Spent. This is one of many books. Where can people find information about your other books and things that you offer?
They could jump on canonpress.com. They've got my stuff, or just Amazon, ND Wilson on Amazon. You'll find everything.
Lists. Lots in there. The title of this book comes from, this is your family's motto. You talk about, there was another vomit story after a generous dinner of saucy meatball subs. And so this is what we say. We say Death by Living. The book is on a way of living, a way of receiving life. Phenomenally, phenomenally funny, entertaining, memorable. And also it makes you introspective. Really, truly, I was surprised how much you packed in. You know, you read so many books that are 180 pages or however long it is. Like, there is a lot in here that all weaves together, but not even in a linear way. And that was another one of the things I loved. It was like this theme came back and this theme came back, and it was all just woven in like how life is. So just absolutely thrilled to have read it. And the quotes have been with me, especially that certain one, for years. What an honor to get to talk with you. Like, really the coolest, because I love the book so much and all that you write. Our household is filled with your books. Real quick, we always end our podcast with the same question, and I have to ask because otherwise people get mad. What's a favorite memory from your childhood that was outside? Tell us a little story.
A favorite memory of my childhood that was outside was, well, I've got a couple, but one was standing in my front yard, so it's outside, but it wasn't really outdoors, but it ties in, watching my house burn down. Like standing there with my parents and watching the roof go in flames was a momentous moment. And it was not a negative moment. Even at the time, I was just like, whoa. And I was so excited, but I was sort of like overwhelmed with the fact that I knew that a chapter just ended. We were about to turn a page. Like, I was like, okay, so here's story. After that, I ended up living in my grandparents' attic for a little while. That in many ways influenced my 100 Cupboards trilogy. But then we also ended up living in the basement of this little house on a pond. And some friends were living upstairs, but we were like ricocheting around, where do we live after your house burns? This pond was full of turtles. And so I have a huge fondness for turtles, but also a ton of memories of just drifting in this little boat, hunting these little hatchlings and all these turtles. And I found one really big one. And I discovered, because I don't know who told, probably my uncle, that turtle shells are made out of the same stuff as your fingernails. And I took some of my sister's fingernail polish and I wrote, "This is Tim," on this turtle's shell in bright pink. And really enjoyed discovering how invisible turtles actually usually are. Mm-hmm. Because I put it back out there and I'd be floating out there with the red-winged blackbirds and, you know, the cattails. And I just spent so much time on that water. But you would see just the letters, just the pink letters swim by into the boat. Just, "This is Tim," just gliding by underneath. And you couldn't see the turtle at all. You just see how often you were not able to see these creatures. So I would say just that summer I spent living on that pond, just collectively, is one of the strongest impressions I have, for sure.
And wouldn't have happened unless your home burnt down.
Yeah,
which is
absolutely
a tragedy.
On the day that my parents accepted an offer to sell it, that night it burned. And it was the doorbell that had never worked once while we lived there that set the house on fire and burned the roof off. And my parents, I never saw them freak out. I never saw them panic. I never felt any kind of instability at all through that entire experience.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like, so you want to talk about them living as effective characters when you just finally sold the house you're trying to sell and then it goes up in smoke that night.
So, wow.
But yeah, and then and out of that, and in the end, my dad and I ended up building a house out of a salvaged shed off the University of Idaho campus. He bought a book called How to Build a House and bought me a hammer, and we started. And so that was like summers out there. There's so many things like that that came from that one moment of shock hardship. So many great, fruitful things. And the fact that my parents didn't freak out is why I was able to live through it and just see all the blessing, like all the blessings that came, as opposed to being worried and fretful and panicking. That was a huge part of it.
Unbelievable. Survival is not the goal. Life is meant to live well. And that's why you have this legacy in your whole family. Nate, this has been such an honor. Thank you so much for being here.
So much fun. Thank you.
Feel like you're the martyr in your family? You're not alone. Hey, this is Joanne.
And Bree.
And we're from the No Guilt Mom podcast. Bree, we talk to a lot of moms.
Yeah, we sure do.
And if you're a mom who has a to-do list that is so massive that you get overwhelmed and you shut down,
or if you fall into the habit of doing everything for everyone and don't know how to change it, we can help you become a no-guilt mom.
We're going to take you from family martyr to family model. That's role model. So that you role model the behavior that you want to see out of your kids.
You're going to go from being tired and overwhelmed to energized and guilt-free.
Every week, you'll get actionable strategies that you can implement right away from the experts that we interview and from us.
We also have a whole lot of fun. So check out the No Guilt Mom podcast everywhere you listen to your favorite shows.